Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Over the past couple of months, people just can't seem to get enough of that new documentary, Get Back, directed and produced by Peter Jackson of Lord of the Rings fame, covers the making of the album Let It Be, uses hours and hours of never-before-seen footage taken of the band during the creative process, and it paints a very personal portrait of the band in those last days and gives you an insight into their working methods and their personality and their interactions that I had never seen before. So here at Nightlife, we thought, what a great time to take a look at the Beatles, not just their musical genius, but mainly as stars of the screen. Looking back at their string of musical film and TV releases, and who better to take us on this fab cinematic journey than Nightlife film critic CJ Johnson. How are you, CJ?
Mark, good. How are you?
I'm very well, mate. Now, would you have called yourself a long-time Beatles fan?
Yeah, I guess I am a long-time Beatles fan. I was introduced to the Beatles as a kid by an uncle of mine, my Uncle Richard, who is a hardcore Beatles fan, a lifer. And he and I used to spend a lot of time together, and he introduced me to the Beatles, I don't know, I think when I was about six or seven. And so my introduction to the Beatles was kind of also, in a way, my introduction to music.
Right.
Because he was kind of teaching me about music at the same time. So I was learning about music through the prism of the Beatles and vice versa. So really, the Beatles were my beginnings.
That's amazing.
My origin story with music. Yeah, absolutely. So yes, I've liked them since I've liked music, I suppose. So yes, I would say, I mean, I'm not obsessive in a way that, for example, my uncle, I suppose, is, and a lot of people are, millions of people are. But every time I come back around to them, I'm reminded that they're the best. Do you know what I mean? Every time I come back around to listening to their albums, or something comes along like this documentary, Get Back, and so I'm back into the zone of the Beatles, I am reminded that they are truly the Mozart, Beethoven, Picasso, the Beatles of music.
Yeah, they are very much the Beatles of music in so many ways.
The Beatles are the Beatles of music.
See, my parents didn't play the Beatles around our house. Not that they didn't like the Beatles. In fact, my mum saw the Beatles when they came to Australia. But when I was growing up, it just wasn't on their general playlist. I don't think we had any of the albums at home when I was growing up. So obviously I knew the Beatles and I knew a lot of the big songs, but it actually wasn't until my late teenage years that I myself started buying the albums. And then I had this fairly excruciating period where I'd say to people, have you ever heard that song, you know, Dear Prudence? And people are like, yeah, it's a Beatles song. Everyone's heard that song. It's sort of, well, I'm just discovering it now at the age of 16.
Well, it's quite incredible. Like, I'm introducing my daughter to the Beatles at the moment, and she's seven. And then she'll be reading one of her books that's, you know, one in a series of books about a little girl, say, who goes to a school somewhere. And she'll go, look, Beatles. And sure enough, there's a sentence about the Beatles. Oh. Or she'll be reading a graphic novel and she'll go, look, Beatles. Or she'll be looking at one of these magazines she gets and she'll go, look, Beatles. Like, they are everywhere.
Yeah.
There are references to them scattered throughout your day. Do you know what I mean? They're all over the place.
And that's the thing, because every so often you meet someone who says, you know, I just don't like the Beatles. And obviously, you know, that's fine. Everyone's entitled to their opinion. But what you can't deny is how much they are just woven into the fabric of our culture. It's really just the Beatles and Elvis are on this tier of being woven into the culture that really no one else touches. No matter how popular they get, their tentacles don't go as far as you do with those two acts.
And I mean, we could suddenly go off on a tangent and never come back from it about why I would suggest that the Beatles are actually continually staying within the culture, where I think Elvis is probably actually starting to slip away. Just because their music spanned so many periods within the short existence of the band, they pass through many periods, and so their music has a modern relevance, whereas I think Elvis's music is kind of a particular type. But anyway,
we're going to get a couple of texts in from Elvis fans as a result of that comment, but that's what Nightlife is all about.
I like Elvis too.
So there's no surprise then that this new documentary has garnered such attention. It came as well, I think, at a good time for a lot of people. Certainly came at a good time for me, at a time when we're not going out as much as we normally would. We're at home. We're just starting to watch. And, you know, in the last few years, there's been that thing called slow TV, you know, where they'll show the entire journey of the Indian Pacific all the way across the Nullarbor, and you can watch it for hours. And this is like the best version of that ever. It's 9 hours or whatever it is of the Beatles rehearsing, and I could have watched it for the rest of my life.
Yeah, as you know, famously, it's culled from about 60 hours of footage and about 140 hours of audio. And theoretically, you know, those of us who are into it could have watched the 60 hours.
I think I could have, yeah.
But, I mean, of course, it's got moments where you see these incredible songs happen, where you see Get Back come into existence, you know, as Paul is sitting there strumming and humming. And it's just, it's moments like that that just make people like us just absolutely flip. It's quite incredible. But see, it's also their charm. And this is what we'll be talking about in a big way in looking at their entire filmography, is that part of the reason we can sit there and watch 9 hours of those four guys in a room noodling and humming and strumming and chatting and eating toast is because we love them as people, besides the fact that we love them as artists and musicians. And part of the reason we love them as people, besides their talent, is their unbelievable charm as individuals and as four friends. And that is what was traded on in their filmography. And we should, you know, start at the beginning with A Hard Day's Night, from which you just played that amazing song. But, you know, these films gave people the ability to sit in a movie theater for an hour and 40 minutes and do what we've done with Get Back over 9 hours, which is to sit in a room with these four very charming young men.
And get to know them. Mm. Let's hear a little bit of some of the scenes from A Hard Day's Night, and we'll talk about it.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log.
Tell me, how did you find America?
Turn left to Greenland.
Has success changed your life?
Yes.
I'd like to keep Britain tidy.
Are you a mod or a rocker?
No, I'm a mocker.
What would you call that hairstyle you're wearing? Arthur.
No, actually, we're just good friends.
What do you call that collar?
Well, a collar.
Oh, do you often see your father?
No, actually, we're just good friends.
Everything seems to be right.
So, at the height of Beatlemania, it was probably inevitable that a film about the Beatles was going to come out. You know, Elvis was making a lot of money with Elvis's movies. It was part of the stock in trade of these big acts. And at the time, no one, of course, probably thought that the Beatles had the staying power that they ultimately proved to have. So film studios wanted to cash in on this phenomenon of Beatlemania. And they made this movie, released in 1964. What do you think of it, CJ?
Well, it's great.
Yeah.
So it really is. A Hard Day's Night is a really, really terrific film. And it's got a lot of qualities. So, yeah, as you said, the people weren't necessarily sure this was going to last. But on the other hand, people didn't know what they had, because the kind of phenomenon that was happening around the Beatles was unprecedented. You know, this kind of hysteria that was happening in crowds of young women around the Beatles was mind-blowing, because it was new. I mean, it had happened around Elvis Presley, and certainly it had happened around other earlier singers, but not to this extent, not on this scale, and not this visibly broadcast on television everywhere they went. You know, this whole thing that was a combination of absolute adoration, and also had this sense of danger, this sense of threat, you know, this idea of these crowds of people literally pursuing these four young men. To what end? Who knows? To touch them, I suppose, to try and rip a piece of their clothes or their hair out. And so, you know, this idea that, okay, well, they're also very, very charming. They're also very, very handsome. They're obviously keenly attractive and sexually attractive. This adds up to feature film material. And so there was this idea to make a film, but then nothing more than that. What would a film possibly be? So enter a guy named Richard Lester. Richard Lester was an American living in London who was lucky enough to be intelligent and driven and ambitious and young and smart at the dawn of television. So he was an early television director as television was still trying to figure itself out. And luckily enough, he found himself in with Spike Milligan and Peter Sellers.
Yeah.
And so he was kind of an unofficial goon. And although he didn't work on the official Goon show, he worked on three other television shows with Peter Sellers and Spike Milligan that were kind of non-official Goon shows as they were sort of switching around networks, etc. So he directed the Goons, basically, in early television. And that's where he found his sort of sense of humor. But likewise, he was giving back. He was part of the creative mix with Spike Milligan and Peter Sellers. So after making a couple of TV series with them, Spike Milligan got himself an actual camera, a 16mm movie camera, and said, Richard, why don't you make a short film with us? So over a couple of weekends, for the grand total of 70 quid, £70, Richard Lester directed this film called The Running, Jumping and Standing Still film, which was a short film. And it went on to be nominated for an Academy Award. And it's kind of silent comedy slapstick starring Spike Milligan and Peter Sellers and Richard Lester and Leo McKern, who pops up in the Beatles films,
yeah,
and some other guys like this. And it's a fun little film. And John Lennon loved it. And the Beatles liked it, but particularly John Lennon loved it. And they were like, that guy who directed that funny little film, that's who should direct our film. And the Beatles all like the Goons anyway. So it was like, well, who's the guy who directs the Goons? That guy.
Yeah.
That guy is the guy we want. So Richard Lester directed them in their first movie, A Hard Day's Night, and in their second movie, Help. And both of those films just exude Goons. You know, you can absolutely see the influence of the Goons on those movies and the style of films those are. And the Goons were probably the most heavily influenced by the Marx Brothers. So you've got this direct line of absurd humor with sort of innocence and at times physical comedy and slapstick and verbal wordplay, wit, all of this stuff that goes from Marx Brothers through the Goons, through the Beatles into A Hard Day's Night. And A Hard Day's Night is a lovely, fun hangout movie. It's a movie where you hang out with the Beatles for 36 hours. There's barely any plot. Basically, yeah, the Beatles have to take a train to London to go be on television. So they've got to go to London, go to a TV studio and sing a couple of songs on TV. That's the plot. So what you're really doing is going along with them and hanging out with them and enjoying their company. They're very young men. They are very fresh-faced. You know, their hair isn't even that long. It's a bit long. It's long enough for older people to look down their noses at them. And one of the big themes of the film, I suppose, is that these men are young and polite and nice, but they are anti-authoritarian. And the older people are generally shown as conservative and sometimes arrogant. And they definitely represent youth. And in the early scenes of the film, that's quite pointed in the way that they are sort of taking on older character types, sort of snotty upper class types. But they're presented as very fresh-faced, lovely young lads, very witty, very cheeky, very charming, and very nice. They're aware of their own attractiveness to women, but they are never played as salacious or sleazy. They flirt with young women throughout the film, but not in a way that ever feels off in any way. And indeed, this is an interesting story told to me by my Uncle Richard, which is in the early scenes when they're on the train heading towards London. That is where George Harrison met, yeah, his wife, Patty Boyd. Patty Boyd had been in an ad for Smith's Crisp that was directed by Richard Lester. And so he remembered her and he said, why don't you play one of the schoolgirls in the train carriage that the boys stop by and have a bit of a moment with?
I think it's McCartney who's flirting with her in the film, isn't it?
He's flirting with her in the film, but yeah, in off when, you know, between takes, it was George Harrison that was flirting with her. And so famously at the end of the day, he said, would you marry me? And when she said, huh? He said, oh, would you at least have dinner with me tonight? That's how the story goes. And they got married. So that's all there in the film. You can see them in the same scene. You can see this moment captured on film of like, okay, those two are going to get together and have a long thing before she went to Eric Clapton, but that's another story.
Yeah.
The film's in black and white. It's beautifully shot. It's really intriguingly shot. It's like well shot. The cinematography is crisp and fun and witty and stylish. And the editing style is super modern. Like, this is a film that is influenced by the French New Wave. There is quick cutting. There are jump cuts. There's intriguing manipulation of the image that places it very much sort of in the avant-garde into what was happening right then in world cinema. And it's quite funny. It's not necessarily laugh out loud funny. The more you like the Beatles, of course, the more charming it is and the funnier it is. But it's very nice, and you really get to hang out with them a lot.
One of the things that I always thought was interesting about it is that it's written by a guy named Alan Owen, who wrote a screenplay, you know, based on his idea of what the personality of the four Beatles was.
Yeah.
And in a way, he created personalities for the Beatles, or a sort of rough pretend version of what their personalities was that kind of set in, you know. It was John Lennon was the rocker, Paul McCartney was the sweet one, Ringo Starr was the misunderstood silly one, and George Harrison was kind of the sardonic one. And that's the way they're depicted in this movie. And whether or not that bore any relationship to real life, it created an idea of who the four Beatles were for the audience.
That's very true, and that's very astute. It absolutely started etching their characters into movie characters, into characteristics, and started etching them in stone. Now, of course, we've gotten to see them for 9 hours sitting around in Get Back. We see that, well, we can see why they were written that way, because it is reflecting their actual characteristics, isn't it? Mm. You know, if George is rather quiet and a bit more serious, and certainly with Ringo. Ringo as a person and as the character Ringo has this boyish, joyous, fun, comedic energy that the movie's really capitalized on. And in A Hard Day's Night, in the third act, basically the only real moment of conflict in the film, and it's barely a moment of conflict, is that Ringo wanders out of the studio and goes wandering around London, and they've got to do their rehearsal in a couple of hours, and no one knows if he's going to make it back or not. And then you go out of the studio and you just follow Ringo around for a while, and he's kind of walking around London. He interacts with some children. He just does his own thing, and it's very much like a Harpo Marx segment in a Marx Brothers movie. And that further defined Ringo as this kind of melancholic clown. And that was the type that he would then continue to play. And indeed, when we get to the next film, Help, he's the engine of the plot, such as it is. One other thing about A Hard Day's Night that because I've watched all these films over the last few nights in preparation for tonight. I'd seen them before, but I've watched them again. I really noticed in A Hard Day's Night, by the time they get to the television studio, very quickly, in the space of about 10 minutes, there are three clearly, if I may be so bold, clearly gay male characters working at the television studio, and they're just going about their business and uncommented on, not joked about, but clearly gay men who work in television. And in 1964, that was pretty cool.
Yeah. I know the characters you're talking about, and it is just kind of, I guess it's a comment in a way on show business and the kind of people who would have worked in the time, or an idea of who would have worked at the time. But you're right, it isn't the kind of camp humor that you might expect from a 60s movie. In fact, they are just normal people going about their jobs.
Yeah, it just reflects the fact that, you know, there's a higher percentage of gay people in the arts. You know, it's just reflecting the actual work environment. As I say, they're not the butt of jokes, and nothing's made out of it. They're just there, and they're clearly gay men working.
There's a story.
I think that was quite progressive.
Yeah, there's a story about the showing of the film to the executives at the network. You probably know this, CJ, where one of the sort of cigar-chomping old-school network execs watched a screening of the film before it came out and said, well, I don't know what the hell that was about, but we're going to make a lot of money.
And it did.
I think it did make a lot of money. And the thing about it is, though, that struck me is it was going to make a lot of money no matter what. They just could have shown the Beatles playing music and doing nothing else, and it would have made a lot of money given the state of Beatlemania at the time. And therefore, it has no right to be as good as it is, but it's genuinely, I think, a good movie. I think the other Beatles movies we're going to talk about are more mixed, but this one is a really good film.
It is a really good film, and it's its own thing. Like, there is nothing else like it. There are other movies starring members of bands. There are movies like Quadrophenia, and there's, you know, there's rock operas like Tommy and everything.
Have you ever seen the Monkees one, Head?
Well, we'll get to Head, because Head is clearly inspired by Help, which is the next Beatles movie.
Yeah, okay.
But this one has its own thing going on. It's a hangout movie. You're just hanging out with these four people that you love. There's some music. There's not a huge amount of music, but every now and then they play their instruments, and we get an entire song, especially once they get into the studio in London. And it's warm and witty, but it's really warm. There's no conflict ever between them. You know, that's how you would actually get the plot going, isn't it? Is it you'd have them arguing between themselves? There's none. They always are friendly, collegiate colleagues with each other.
Who would you say, on the evidence of this film, is the most naturally gifted actor amongst the four of them?
Oh, Ringo. Ringo.
You think
it's
so?
Clear. Yeah. Oh, it's clear. Yeah, Ringo steals all the films. It's clear that he is more of an actor than the others. And he went on to have a bigger acting career than the others. John had a little bit of an acting
How
career.
How I Won the War, he was in, and a few others.
George, of course, became a film producer by establishing a company called Handmade Films. And he made movies, but he didn't act. Paul never really acted. So John acted in a few. But Ringo went on to have an entire film career. I mean, he's acted in quite a few films, like probably over a dozen films.
Yeah.
And you can tell in this one, in A Hard Day's Night, like I don't think that sequence where he goes wandering around London was particularly scripted. I think over the course of shooting it, they realized that they had something in him. So like, let's give him his own like 10-minute bit. And he was famously hungover for that.
Yeah, too. Which contributed to his dour performance.
Yeah.
Okay.
So should we get on to Help?
Let's get on to Help.
So this is the famous Beatles.
We need protection.
Get me protection.
People. Hold.
The ring. She's not wearing the sacrificial ring.
In the name of science, I demand that ring.
They expect me to cut my finger off.
So, the police are extended, giving the famous protection for which we are justly proud in this country, for a finger, eh?
Hands up. Hands up. Quick, quick.
Will John live to sleep in his pit again? Will Paul ever get back his electric organ? Will George be reunited with his ticker tape machine? Ringo, will he ever play the drums again?
Help! I need somebody. Help! Not just anybody. Help! You know I need someone.
Now, you mentioned that A Hard Day's Night is fairly thin on plot and thin on the number of locations.
Yeah.
I would say Help has a surfeit of both.
Yeah, well, it's funny because that trailer you just played, that actually makes the stakes seem higher than they are, you know, because really, once again, this is a pretty ramshackle, loose-limbed, shaggy dog film, but it tries to construct a little bit of a plot because it actually tries to be something different to A Hard Day's Night. A Hard Day's Night is, in a way, a mockumentary about 36 hours in the life of the actual Beatles. And it incorporates, you know, the female fandom chasing them around and the screaming and all of that and the running into taxis and trains and all of this. And, you know, TV studio, it feels like a satire about their real life, a warm comedy about their real life. Whereas Help is a comedy movie with a comedy plot. And the comedy plot is based on the fact that Ringo has a ring that has to go. Ringo's ring has to go.
See how they came up with that.
I mean, is it really that? I mean, it sounds like something John Lennon would come up with, doesn't it? It's like, hey, Ringo's ring's got to go. And they're like, okay, well, how can we build on that? So Ringo has a ring that's got a big red jewel on it. And it turns out that this sort of cult in the East, it's never named as India or Pakistan, or it's never named specifically, it's just in the East, because none of the characters are played by people of those nationalities. They're nearly all played by British actors in something you couldn't do now, including Leo McKern in playing a kind of Eastern type.
Yeah, and Warren Mitchell's there as well, I think, as a fairly broad stereotype too.
Yeah, you wouldn't get away with it these days. It's not quite Peter Sellers in The Party, but it verges on that. Anyway, Leo McKern and a bunch of others play these cult members from the East who need to conduct a sacrifice, and the way a human sacrifice, and the way that they need to conduct this sacrifice is they need to put this ring on the finger of the person they're going to sacrifice, and they discover that Ringo Starr of the Beatles has the ring. So they've got to get the ring off his finger. And it turns out that it's stuck on his finger. So Ringo doesn't want them to come kill him and chop off his finger to get the ring. So he and the band, sort of following along with him, go on a series of adventures to try and get this ring removed from his finger. And that's kind of the plot. So Ringo and the Beatles are going around trying to get the ring removed from Ringo's finger. And meanwhile, they're being chased, essentially, by this rather nefarious cult from the East. It's kind of meant a little bit as a spoof of James Bond movies, but not very much. Like, at the very beginning, there is a score played that is very obviously, very clearly, very blatantly a jokey riff on the James Bond theme, but then the idea kind of gets dropped.
And is that like a serve back
to a hangout?
Is that a serve back because in Goldfinger, James Bond makes fun of the Beatles?
Gosh, I mean, would you make an entire feature film as a serve back? Potentially, you know, who knows? It's entirely possible. I think what they wanted to do, I think they had more money. They wanted to make a bigger film, and I think that meant that they felt like they would travel a bit. And so I guess one thought led to another, and like, well, those James Bond films, they travel around the world. Let's travel around the world. So in the course of the film, kind of over three acts, the Beatles go from London, a lot in London, a lot in their house, actually. And we'll talk about their house in a second. And then they go to the Alps, and then they go to the Bahamas. And so you've got the Beatles in London. You've got the Beatles skiing in the snow. And of course, James Bond famously went to the snow often. And then they go to the Bahamas and look like they're having an absolutely lovely time in the Bahamas. But the first act in London, it's got some really great sight gags. Like, the famous sight gag that is so good very early on in the film is the four boys walk into their four terrace houses in a row, and two old ladies watch them from across the road, and they're like, oh, aren't they nice? They haven't changed. You know, they still live in the same street. They're very, 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 you know, modest. They're humble. And they all open their doors, and then we cut to inside, and inside there are no walls between the four houses, and it turns out they're walking into one huge mansion in which they all live in this kind of Jacques Tati playtime, play world type of vibe, where they, like, they've got vending machines and it's got all sorts of modcons and futuristic devices. And John Lennon lives inside this sunken bedroom in the middle of the main living space, which is just so cool and cozy and awesome. So he sort of goes down into this bed world where he sleeps and he listens to music and he plays his guitar. They all sleep in the same room because it's one huge cavernous space. So there's a lovely shot where they all go to sleep and they're all just sleeping in the same room in their own little beds. You know, they're innocents. They're made to be these sort of innocent type characters, you know, these lovely boys who all share one bedroom, essentially. And they're pursued by these crazy cultists led by Leo McKern and Victor Spinetti, the long-nosed, very funny British actor from the first film, from A Hard Day's Night. And then over the course of trying to get this ring removed, they go to the Alps, and then they say they go to the Bahamas. And what happens in this film is more times than in A Hard Day's Night. In A Hard Day's Night, when they stop to play, it's kind of for the story, like they're in the studio, so they play, right? But in Help, all of a sudden, the film will just stop and they'll play a song. And yeah, those songs, you can actually cut them out and they actually serve as music videos. And so in this film, Richard Lester essentially invented the modern music video. And the way he shot those songs is fantastic. His camera angles are really interesting. They're really witty. There's a lot of close-ups of instruments. There's a lot of really interesting framing of instruments heavy in the frame and then one Beatle and then a second Beatle beyond them with their instrument. I mean, they really look really, really good. And they set the template for how bands were shot for years and years to come. Because before that, bands were usually just shot straight on in a row, you know, like almost like a proscenium arch. But now he was shooting them, you know, using the full three dimensions, moving around them and using them to fill the frame in front of each other, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And also moving them around spatially so that they weren't always standing in the same position over the course of singing a song. So they sing in the snow, they sing in London, they sing in the Bahamas. My favorite of the songs in Help is John Lennon's You've Got to Hide Your Love Away, which is just shot in the house. They shoot
Which
Ticket
is kind
to Ride.
Of John Lennon trying to do a little bit of a Dylan-esque type song, I always thought.
I think it's pretty clear that that song is influenced by Dylan, absolutely. But I love that song, and it's beautiful. It's the standalone kind of nature of the version in Help is really nice. They do Ticket to Ride in the snow. They do The Night Before in a war field, wearing like uniforms, because a lot of the thing that runs through their films also is a sort of gentle satire about war. And then they do Another Girl in the Bahamas. And those are sort of the four standout songs in the film. But there are others as well.
Let's hear just a little bit of a song from the film. This is She's a Woman.
A great song.
It is a great song, isn't it? It's one of the ones that it's actually doesn't have the kind of video clip that you talked about in the film, but it does appear a few times throughout it. And I wanted to play it because it's one of those Beatles songs that doesn't get played on the radio as often these days as some others.
So besides their songs, there's also obviously score music, like in any movie, there's background score. But in this movie, the background score, the incidental score, is usually lovely orchestral versions of earlier Beatles songs. And that adds a whole other interesting texture to the film that's really quite lovely. Now, Help is in color too, which demarcates it from A Hard Day's Night. A Hard Day's Night is in a beautiful black and white. Help is in vibrant color. It is much more striving to make you laugh. It's much more trying to be a comedy. There's more deliberate slapstick. The Beatles are playing more for laughs. And so it's got a different flavor. And I reckon it is very clear that it anticipates the Goodies, the TV show The Goodies. It anticipates the Monkees and their TV show and also their movie Head. the style of the TV show of the Monkees and the style of the movie Head are very clearly influenced by Help. I would say that the style of the Batman TV show is hugely influenced by Help. And even down to like the airplane movies, the Flying High movies are influenced by this film, because this film is not afraid for an absurd visual gag. Do you know what I mean? Someone will say something and then you'll see like a physical version of that, that kind of humor that just throw any gag at the screen and see what sticks kind of stuff that the airplane and Flying High movies have. So there's a lot of this was an influential movie, not only in terms of like the modern video clip, but in terms of this type of humor. And I mean, obviously it comes from the Goons, but then it, along with the Goons, helps anticipate Monty Python clearly. So they're in this beautiful line of absurd, gentle British humor that with some of the great British comedians of all time.
Well, let's turn now to perhaps an even more absurd entry into their filmic canon, or TV canon, as this one was. This is Magical Mystery Tour.
Yeah.
When a man buys a ticket for a Magical Mystery Tour, he knows what to expect. We guarantee him the trip of a lifetime, and that's just what he gets. The Incredible Magical Mystery Tour.
So they had two really, really good movies with Hard Day's Night and Help, and then they followed up with this TV special that was sort of conceptualized by Paul McCartney. How well do you think this one holds up?
Not well. Yeah. I will call this Paul's Folly. Now, it's got certain things to recommend it, absolutely, but, you know, it is not A Hard Day's Night, which is awesome, nor is it Help, which is great fun and has many other qualities. It's a bit of a misfire. It's Paul had this idea to do this TV special. It's under an hour long, so it's by no means, you know, a feature film. It's very much a TV special. It looks rather cheap and all of that. And basically, once again, Ringo's the lead. Ringo and I think his grandmother, I think his grandfather's just died, so he takes his grandmother on a magical mystery tour, which is to get on a bus with a busload of British people and go to a mysterious place within Britain. And I got to say, Magical Mystery Tour as an artifact, it might be the most British thing ever made. It is just so, so British, from the type of tour, the bus tour, the Magical Mystery Tour, to every single person on the bus. It's, you know, British people on tour in Britain doing British things. And every time they get off the bus, they're doing something very British, like going to a military museum. And I think it's really quite interesting, because the Beatles in this, and it says it's, you know, by the Beatles at the end of it. So Paul was definitely the band leader for this film. But, you know, they all weighed in, and John Lennon famously weighed in with some of the ideas for some of the skits, etc. It is clear that the Beatles, outside of their music, one of their things was, as exemplified in Magical Mystery Tour, to both satirize all things British while also venerating all things British. Mm. Magical Mystery Tour is a satire of British stuff, but it also loves British stuff. And I think you can do that. I think you can lovingly joke about something. And Magical Mystery Tour is lovingly joking about Britain and being British. And at times the satire about Britishness is quite savage, but it's always done with love. And you can tell that this kind of tour, as cheesy it is also something that they just love, this kind of stuff. Now, it does feature a couple of standalone, once again, video clip type things. Now, this was not directed by Richard Lester, and you'd certainly know it. You know, it doesn't have the same skill level. But the I Am the Walrus that occurs about halfway through it is pretty excellent, and it's pretty crazy.
It's
and
a real moment in psychedelia, I think. It looks incredible.
Yeah, and they all are wearing these walrus outfits and other outfits at times. It's a bit spooky. It's a bit pagan. And it's cool. John looks really cool singing. His voice sounds cool. It's a cool little clip. But then a little later, George's Blue Jay Way is a bit much. It goes into total psychedelia, and it's It's not my favorite song anyway, but and the way that they shoot it and the stuff they do with the camera effects and everything, it's definitely dated a bit.
Well, speaking of psychedelia, let's get to their third feature film now.
The Forces of Good, The Beatles, The Boob.
I must complete my bust. Two novels, finish my blueprints, begin my begee.
Hey, Jeremy, must you always talk in rhyme?
If I spoke prose, you'd all find out. I don't know what I talk about. He's a real nowhere
man sitting in... So this is the animated film of Yellow Submarine, which is quite beloved amongst certain members of the community. How do you think it holds up today?
Well, I watched it with my daughter this week. It's bonkers, man. It is crazy. She really enjoyed it. She'd never seen anything like it. I think, you know, the closest thing she'd seen to it are the Studio Ghibli films, because the Studio Ghibli films are a bit more abstract and a bit more wild than, you know, films like Disney or other stuff like that. It is bonkers. It's very psychedelic. It's 1968 at its most 1968. Now, the thing about Yellow Submarine is it's not a Beatles film in the same way that Help and A Hard Day's Night are, because they really didn't have anything to do with it. It
except
was made
music,
out
yeah.
except the music. All the music in the song in the film is their music, and they're actually playing it. It's the tracks. They just use the tracks, but their voices are not voicing the characters of them in the film. So the film is about the four Beatles, particularly Ringo. He's kind of got the most lines and the most screen time, as they get in this yellow submarine to evade and try and help figure out how to defeat the blue meanies, who are these people who are attacking people. It's you don't go to it for the plot. And I think in 1968, you also went to it with a head full of other stuff, if you know what I mean. I mean, clearly it's a trip movie. It's clearly designed to be seen while you're stoned. It's okay. Clearly that way. But the Beatles loved it. Once they saw it, they loved it. John Lennon particularly loved it. He said it was his favorite of the Beatles movies. And so they liked it enough that they were willing to go and then film a short segment, a very short segment, of the four of them doing a bit of wacky business that is at the end of the film. And that was kind of giving their imprimatur to it. But also, of course, their songs are throughout. It's the animation style is fascinating, because it looks like nothing else. There is no other film in the world like Yellow Submarine for what it is. But the animation style that it anticipates is what Terry Gilliam then starts doing for Monty Python. That's what it looks like. It looks like Terry Gilliam's animations that he later does for Monty Python in many ways, because it's absurd. The proportions are all out of kilter. You know, someone might have a very large belly and a very small face against a very large building with a very small, you know, car next to all that kind of stuff. The colors. It's fun. It's not very funny. Like the actual dialogue is not particularly smart or clever, but boy, are there songs. There are so many good songs in this film. It's a true musical. About every 4 or 5 minutes, it stops and you get a full song with just a whole lot of psychedelic cartoon stuff going on.
Yeah, I haven't watched the full film with my kids, but I have watched the Yellow Submarine animated sequence, which is on YouTube with my kids, and they love that. They love watching that little clip because it's just so colourful and strange, and they love the song, and it's really holds up as just a great fun kids thing in spite of the, as you say, perhaps drug psychedelia side to it.
Yeah, and that's not a problem. Like it's no one in the film, no character in the film actually takes drugs. It doesn't wear its drugginess on its sleeve, totally wearing it on its sleeve. And you know, it's fine for kids. It's a very G-rated film. My daughter just kept laughing at the absurdity of it, because the things that they show, you know, so often it doesn't make any kind of sense whatsoever, and that is what is funny about it. And of course the music is just absolutely terrific. There are some famous gags that make it, like for example, the bad characters are these bluish characters, and you know, there's jokes about like, you don't look bluish and stuff like that. Yeah. Which is sort of, but it's gentle, good fun. It was a big hit too. Like, people went to see the film, and it was a critical hit as well.
Okay, now let's very quickly talk about the Beatles cartoon series, which is probably rather welcomely forgotten by a lot of people.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible. So you can see most of the Beatles cartoons on YouTube. They were made for a couple of years in 1965. And I remember seeing them as a kid. And I remember, I suppose, liking them, but I liked the Beatles. And so I guess that helped me like the cartoons. I watched a few of these on YouTube, again with my daughter, but she wasn't into them. She actually said, I don't understand what's going on. They're very sloppily scripted. Like for 8-minute cartoons to not hold up on a story level, they must be pretty terrible. And the animation is very, very, very crude. The cartoons are clearly inspired by Hard Day's Night. So that's the version of the Beatles that you get in the cartoons, which is the sort of the clean cut, shorter haired, suit wearing, pleasant young Beatles. Whereas the Beatles you get in Yellow Submarine are the psychedelic Beatles with mustaches and long hair and beards and long flamboyant coats and that whole thing. And the main thing going on in the cartoons is the main thing going on in A Hard Day's Night, which is that hordes of women are after these guys, are chasing after these guys on the streets, and they need to avoid these women by getting into cars and carriages and houses and all that sort of stuff, and basically stopping them from being mobbed. And that sort of hysteria is kind of an ongoing theme in the cartoons. The depictions of the Beatles themselves are very fine. You know, the drawings of the four Beatles look good. So it's fun on that level to watch, you know, your four favorite people as cartoons wandering around in incoherent storylines. Once again, of course, it almost goes without saying, the Beatles didn't do the voices. So there were actors doing their voices very well. I was always convinced it was actually them.
Mm. Well, we've only got a few minutes left. We talked a bit about the new Get Back film at the beginning of this hour, but let's talk about the original version that used that footage, which is the 1970 documentary Let It Be.
Yeah, so for those of our listeners who've seen Get Back, a big character in Get Back is Michael Lindsay Hogg, the director of this footage, trying to make something out of filming these guys making their album Let It Be. And Michael Lindsay Hogg has a fascinating backstory because he is probably the illegitimate son of Orson Welles and all this stuff. He wrote a whole book about it that I read that's really good. So he conceived this thing and this idea of putting them together and forcing them essentially to come up with an album while he filmed them doing so, with the hope that they would then perform the songs in some environment. He wanted them to do it out in the desert for, you know, 20,000 people. They ended up doing it on the roof, you know. So he edited this footage together and put it out in 1970 as a pretty much 90-minute documentary called Let It Be. And Get Back does the same thing over 9 hours, but gives us a different take, because the take Get Back gives us shows us a band being creative. The 90-minute version that Michael Lindsay Hogg cut together and released as Let It Be in 1970 shows you a band breaking up. Same footage or access to the same footage, but completely cut differently. Because what happened was, by the time Let It Be came out, the Beatles had broken up. So he put it out essentially to show the story of what we were all reeling from. The Beatles have broken up. Here, look, here's a movie showing them breaking up.
Yep.
But they hadn't actually broken up when he shot the footage. He was just able to edit the footage to tell that story. So it's an interesting sort of feat of editing, I suppose. But Get Back kind of makes it redundant, and it makes it especially redundant because of all the things that we've talked about this evening. Let It Be is pretty much the only one that you cannot see anywhere.
Yeah.
It is essentially buried from view. Whereas Yellow Submarine, you can get streaming. Help, you can get streaming. Hard Day's Night, you can get streaming. The cartoons, you can watch on YouTube. Magical Mystery Tour, you can get on streaming or probably on YouTube. But Let It Be is really hard to find. It's kind of been... it's been beetled. It's been apple cored.
I have seen it though, and it is it's a hard watch, and it creates unfair portrayals, I think, of especially Yoko Ono, something that's a bit corrected in Get Back. But also how he could have left certain footage on the floor, like that he had the footage of McCartney willing Get Back the song out of nothing with his sheer power of riffingness, and he left it on the editing floor.
Yeah, he wanted to make a feature-length documentary for cinema release, so he wanted to keep it lean, and he really focused on the conflict between George and Paul, and as you say, the presence of Yoko in the room. So it's a very dark film. In fact, it's rather astonishing that that film can exist and get back can exist from the same footage and tell these two radically different stories. Intriguingly, of course, in Get Back, you do see, you know, that whole thing going on with George breaking up or leaving the band for 3 or 4 days and all of that stuff. But the way it's told the way it kind of happened, as opposed to in Let It Be, it emphasizes that and makes that the story.
My guest has been our regular film critic here on Nightlife, CJ Johnson, to talk about the Beatles' storied history on the cinematic screen. Thanks, CJ.
Can I quickly rate them?
Yeah, let's do it. Quick, we've got 20 seconds.
Days Night, number one. Help, number two. Yellow Submarine, number three. Magical Mystery Tour, number four.
I think that is a very fair rating. Magical Mystery Tour with a bullet at number four. Thanks, CJ.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.